Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm Brett King.
And I'm Jason Henricks. Every week since 2013, we explore the personalities, startups, innovators, and industry players driving disruption in financial services.
From incumbents to unicorns, and from cutting-edge technology to the people using it to help create a more innovative, inclusive, and healthy financial future. I'm JP Nichols, and this is Breaking Banks.
Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast. I'm Brett King, and joining me today in the co-hosting chair is the inimitable David Birch, or Dave Birch, the author of The Currency Cold War and Identity is the New Money. Is a Cold War coming? Currency Cold War coming, Dave?
A Cold War is definitely coming, and I just read in the South China Morning Post only today about people in the Chinese government urging separation from the dollar. So my mystic powers are intact, Brett. You've got nothing to worry about.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I did see that. I did see they're proposing to unhinge from the US dollar. What's the correct term?
You're only thinking about unhinged because you read it from me, but decouple, I think.
Decouple. Yes, thank you very much. I was looking for the word. So we are going to talk about identity infrastructure today and how that is changing as a result of coronavirus. Coronavirus has exposed reliance on long outdated and insecure identity metrics, primarily built around a signature, which was instituted in the first century. So we see identity theft, we see fraud potentially increasing during lockdown. But who wins and loses out of this? Well, those that already have a clear digital onboarding and identity verification process built into their stack may have some advantages. So we thought we'd bring in some experts on this today to get into the weeds on how coronavirus is going to affect identity and how it's affecting onboarding and acquisition of customers in the COVID and post-COVID age. So we'd like to, first of all, introduce from Jumio, Simon Winchester. He's the Vice President of EMEA. And from Metro Bank, David Thomason, the Chief Commercial Officer. He was previously the Director for Digital and Payments. So David and Simon, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Hi, everyone.
Hello. Thank you very much.
Now, Simon, you guys are right in the midst of this IDV. That's identity verification technology. Some refer to this as part of the KYC or Know Your Customer suite of tools. I like to joke that KYC stands for Kill Your Customers with Paperwork still. But can you, first of all, give us a little bit of background about Jumio? Because you guys have been around for a while. How did you come to be? And what's the sort of foundation story of Jumio as an identity vendor?
Sure, Brett. No problem. And thanks again for invite today. So look, Jumio was founded about 10 years ago. In fact, we recently had our 10-year anniversary. So great milestone for the company. We're HQ'd in Silicon Valley, but my job for the last 6 years has been to build out our EMEA operations. And I'm lucky enough to be part of a team that just keeps growing from strength to strength. Jumio are a trusted identity as a service. We're an identity platform that takes away, contrary to what you just said, Brett, we take away the complexity of verifying real-world identity of digital consumers. So whether we're opening a bank account or renting a car or booking accommodation, those KYC, Know Your Customer, or anti-money laundering regulations and a consumer's desire for trust and safety drive the need for Jumio services. At the beginning, if we rewind those 10 years, Jumio emerged to fill the void of digital onboarding. At that time, interacting with customers required manually sending various pieces of identity documentation, meeting couriers in a location, or even unnecessary branch visits. And that's how we started. And I do totally agree, with what you were saying and joking about. It is cumbersome and very tiring. So that's how we started. And then our growth continued and expedited over the years as businesses became less reliant on traditional means of digital verification, largely through processes like KBA, knowledge base authentication, which at this stage, to be honest, does little more than let you know that someone has my identity information. Don't know who, but someone probably does. And with the number of increasing breaches and hacks that we see on a daily basis, these methods are increasingly unreliable. And so that's how Jumio has evolved over time. Today, Jumio is providing our customers an AI-powered identity platform that verifies government-issued IDs from across the world. We use a wealth of data sets to verify things like residency, whether you're legally allowed to drive a vehicle, if you exist on a PEPSN sanctions list. And then also on top of that, we have a facial biometric solution to ensure that you really are who you are claiming to be. So I guess that's a little bit of our story and how we've evolved over the last 10 years.
Great. So are you on any list, Dave?
I hope I'm on all of them.
Yeah, I did.
You know my motto, Brett, today. You can't monetize obscurity.
All right. Well, let's jump into a little bit of detail how banks are tackling the process of moving from paper-based, signature-based authentication to digitally-based authentication. So, David, give us a little bit of background on the whole evolution of digital banking at Metro and what led to you going down the path of digital onboarding.
Sure. And I don't know if people have got a good understanding of Metro Bank and who we are, but just a very quick potted history.
Yeah, sure.
So in a very similar way to Jumio, we are now approaching our 10th birthday. And 10 years ago, we were the first bank on the high street to get a banking license in the UK for something like 134 years or something crazy. Fast forward 10 years, the world has changed quite a lot in that regard. I think everyone would agree. But at that time, and still to this day, we hold a tenet that there is a place for physical banking. Let's use that argument. And so we still have what we believe are high-quality service models with our store network. So branches in many banks, we actually treat them as retail stores. And 10 years ago, we were leading the way in terms of the ability to open a current account or a transaction account through a store journey where we were able to get customers through in a very quick time and come out with something tangible, which is a working debit card, if you wanted it, God forbid, a checkbook or whatever else you wanted there, you could be up and running and you would have access to at the time, an online banking system up and running. That is absolutely a valid model, and we still see plenty of customers wanting to take those choices with regards to how they choose to open a relationship with a bank like our own, where that high touch service model is still very much appreciated. But at the same time, we're not blind to the fact that the world has moved on massively digitally. And a number of years ago now, we set forth in building out our digital capabilities around how to get customers onboarded digitally and how they could begin to experience that wider surface proposition that we hold to be of high value in Metro. And so we started, I think it was back in 2017 now, to work with Jumio for our retail current account side of things. So initially, a desktop enabled service. It took the selfie concept, and we use selfie. Simon, you gave it its full title, but effectively selfies and the idea of matching documentation to the person. We embedded that into our retail current account proposition, which went live about 2 years ago now. I can't throw too many stats out there for obvious reasons, but it's fair to say that the take-up of our current account application online, CAO as we call it, has been phenomenal and continues to serve its purpose hugely with regards to that.
Current account onboarding.
Current account online, that was the
current
language.
Account
but yeah,
online.
CAO, yeah. We should have called it CAB, current account digital, but we move on. So yeah, we did that 2 years ago, and it is a powerhouse. It is a mega store, to use that term, with regards to the volume and nature of customers we're taking through. I should say at the time of implementation, the challenges, I'm going to use the word internally, in changing hearts and minds around what it is we wanted to do, how a system could possibly be better than a human in determining and recognizing documentation and proving that person who is who they said they were. That was a massive challenge for Metro. And we set the bar. Oh yeah, hugely. Yeah. We have compliance functions, we have a risk function, right. You have, you know, and they're all trying to do their job, which is to manage against their obligations as set out by governments and all that good stuff and make sure that Metro was not letting baddies through the front door. So, you know, getting people comfortable with the idea that a system can be more effective, more systematic and more thorough than you know, a 25-year-old who's never seen one of these documents before and expecting them to know that that's genuine or not. That was a huge, huge mindset shift in the organization, even though we were only, at that point, 7-8 years old. You know, we employ people to be conservative and risk-averse in nature. But huge success, undoubtedly a massive powerhouse in terms of our ongoing recruitment into the bank.
So you're now agnostic as to the methodology.
Well, let me go here. Let me just go on a little bit, if I may. So we're now at the point where we're about to launch the same capability for businesses. And we've literally quite quietly gone live with a solution we're now proving out right now, which again embeds Jumio's capabilities at the heart of the onboarding for businesses. So we'll start with relatively small scale businesses, and we hope to extend that out to more complex businesses, because frankly, we know the demand's there. And then at the same time, we know that the systems that we've used, the proven capabilities that Jumio have provided to us to date, is actually a better vehicle for onboarding customers and identifying and verifying them than what we have in store. And I guess the next wave of that, we get through this digital onboarding journey for businesses, is how we embed those technologies into our physical environments, because it reduces the risk. It reduces the complexity associated with relying on humans who, you know, have got many, many different things to do all day, every day, as they try and service our customers. It reduces that risk for humans, and we begin to embed those more systematic capabilities into all points where a customer can join us.
Can I just come in on that, Brett? Because I think David's raised a couple of really interesting points there that I think people really should just reflect on a little bit. So the first point is this issue about systems being better than people at doing this. And I think that has, we've been in a slightly paradoxical situation up until now, where the sort of guidelines and recommendations have gone on about you have to go to a branch and show a passport to somebody, which is like literally like this is the least secure way of actually onboarding somebody. You're not showing your passport to some forgery detecting genius, who you're just talking to somebody who's going to tick a box in something. And it's really, I think it's really significant that the FATF, so the Financial Action Task Force guidelines, are what all the banks have to.
These are the guys who police anti-money laundering and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I don't want to make any comments about the efficacy of the regime at the moment, but the point is you have to do what FATF says, broadly speaking. And in March, FATF brought out their new guidelines, and the revised FATF guidelines say absolutely explicitly that digital onboarding in some circumstances, i.e. when it's done properly, and this is where people like Jumio come in, when other or digital onboarding companies are available, of course, but when digital onboarding is done properly, it's actually better than physical onboarding. And I just want to draw a distinction there between digital and remote, because what the FATF said was digital onboarding is better. They didn't say anything about local or remote. And so this opens up, and I think a good case study of this is what RBC have been doing in Canada, where they updated their app to do the passport scanning and stuff. I don't know whether that's Jumio or somebody else. But the point is, what they wanted was to retain the customer intimacy and so on. So you go into the branch and you scan your passport in front of the clerk, and it comes up on his system, and it's all done automatically. So the clerk isn't wasting time trying to tell if your Portuguese fishing license is a forgery or not. That's all done in the background for him. And he can get on with delivering personal service while the KYC is done digitally. So the first point is, David is not only 100% correct, but actually a window into a much bigger and much more important change in this whole onboarding thing, which is the recognition that digital onboarding can be better. And that doesn't matter whether it's local or remote. So the distinction between digital and physical onboarding is really important. The distinction between local and remote really isn't. So it doesn't matter whether you're doing your digital onboarding in the branch or online. So That's the first point I'd just like to make. And I also want to make a point about, you know, David touched on this issue about business onboarding. And I wouldn't speak for the US because I don't know the situation, but certainly in the UK, the crisis, the COVID crisis, threw up the lack of business digital identity infrastructure.
Yeah, it's still a problem in the US.
It's a really serious problem, you know.
In the US, it's only really sole entrepreneur businesses, very small businesses that are allowed to onboard digitally. So, yeah, it's a big problem.
Well, and so so you got into this crazy situation where you know, so my bank, where I've been for years, which is also the bank of my business and the bank of another business, called up to ask for proof of address. They wanted proof of my address. So I sent them a letter that they'd sent me. I just put it in an envelope and sent it back for proof of address. And
they were not amused.
But it's crazy. So you know, you're trying to get these stimulus payments out to businesses. You're trying to help businesses. You're trying to get them to keep people on board. And the banks, through no fault of their own, are tied up in knots trying to comply with a set of Edwardian onboarding principles in the absence of any digital identity infrastructure for companies. It's one thing to know that 15 megabytes is a real company. You can go and look that up at Companies House, although why you'd bother, I have no idea, because there's no security on those entries. Anybody can type anything they want into those entries. But then to work out that, yes, Dave Burt is an authorized signatory and blah, 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 and this is their bank account, none of that stuff was there. So, you know, I just want to say, David just touched on it in passing, but I actually think this is one of the next big things is business identity, not just, you know, customer identity.
Absolutely agree. I will ask the audience that's listening here, if there's anyone out there from a bank that has experience processing Portuguese phishing licenses, please contact us at Breaking Banks. We'd love to have you on to talk about that. Just joking, Dave. All right. David, maybe if I come back to you on this, give us a little bit more detail on the points David made around speed and efficiency of processing identity verification.
Yeah, and I apologize, I glossed over that when I was talking about it. I mean, frankly, it's a lot faster to go through a digital onboarding process than it is to have people looking at documents, scanning documents themselves, checking documents with other people. Right? It's cheaper, but it's actually more efficient in terms of the amount of time it takes a customer to go through the process. And you know, I can throw timings on that. You know, we're reducing things by 75% in terms of the time it takes to safely and securely onboard a customer. And as a bank that prides itself on its service ethic, to do that efficiently for a customer and to make it as easy as possible for them using digital technologies has a huge win around it as much as anything. And if I may, just one more point you talked about there, the government incentives, David, there with regards to some of the things happening here in the UK. It is deeply ironic that the government's relied heavily on the bank's existing KYC and KYB checks to support access to that government stimulus. It's been a really, really interesting experiment at the time when, A, we were in lockdown, so many, many branches and stores were closed, or frankly, other people were very unwilling to travel to go and do these things, and yet go through that same process. We can all see Twitter.
I just have to tell you, David, I won't say anything about which particular bank, but my funniest, and I'm not picking on, you know, the banks had problems to deal with in all of this. It's not just bank bashing. But I got a text message from a bank which said, come and log in and get a coronavirus loan. We really want to help you. We're there to serve you, right? So I click on the link. It goes to the website and it says, apply for your, I can't remember what they were called, coronavirus support loan.
Sybil's.
Yeah. Apply for your thing here. So I click the button and up comes a page which says, all you have to do to apply for a loan is to call this number. So then I phone the number and you get a recorded message saying, sorry, we're busy. You're currently in a queue of 11 hours. And I'm like, well, you know, I'm not just bashing the banks because it's the lack of infrastructure that causes this. But the virus has shown up. And we've talked before, and certainly we've talked on this show before, about the priority of finally doing something about identity. And the virus just showed in sharp relief what happens when you don't have an infrastructure.
So talking about that sort of infrastructure, Simon, maybe let's get into this sort of as a standards issue. Where is it that you know, we can sort of definitively say today that an AI or an algorithm, you know, is better than a human where humans need to be involved in the process?
Yeah, I think that's a two-part answer, in my opinion. The first on the human element, and that's touching on what the gents have just said. David was talking about blurring the human and digital experience via AI, Jumio, etc. in store. Jumio applied that same methodology of blurring AI and humans even in our own process. So I mentioned the 250 million IDs that we've verified around the world. That comes from over 200 countries, over 4,000 different ID types. And what that means is we don't just verify, say, passports. We verify the identity document that's in your back pocket. And that might be the driving license or a national ID card, resident permit, visa.
Portuguese fishing license.
Yeah, fishing permit, you name it. They're all there. It's the ID that's important to you. But the reason I bring this up is because it creates a huge data set that is then used to train our algorithms. And that is no easy task. And this is where the human element comes in. And we have teams, vast teams of hundreds of people that are tagging data to efficiently improve the algorithms to then go and do the business that we're talking about. As an example, if an ID expires, it will get punched. The algorithm needs to know what that hole looks like and where that hole will be on an ID, and then extrapolate that across all of the different security features for all of the 4,000 different ID types that we support. And before you know it, you know, you start to understand the sheer size of the project in front of you. And that's how we blend AI and humans to ensure that we're QAing our technology and keeping performance as high as it possibly can, so that when it lands in store in Metro or in their business or consumer journeys, the SLA is a matter of seconds, but the accuracy is up here. So I just wanted to address that quickly. In terms of the standard side, this is quite a strong bugbear for me. And you know, Dave has mentioned some standards from the FAFT already. There generally is not a consensus in my mind about standards for digital identity, identity verification. So you have EIDAS or the fourth or fifth or soon to be sixth anti-money laundering directive, PSD2, GDPR, you name it, they're all there. But there is limited granularity that allows, let's take businesses in the EU, to say wholeheartedly across the EU, this is the standard, this is how we will do things. Instead, what you get is an interpretation of a high-level standard that creates pockets of accepted procedures in UK and Ireland compared to the Nordics, compared to DAG. And you know, for an organization, for a bank who operates across these different territories, all of a sudden you're creating a situation where they're needing to rework their journeys to fit each compliance mandate or legislation across those different countries.
No, you're absolutely spot on. And what's more, there's no standard for communicating that either. So to make a real infrastructure, I'd need to be able to walk into a bank in Ireland, just to use that example, with my Barclays bank identity from the UK and open a new account. For that to happen, it's not just about communicating my name and address and stuff like that. It's also something to do with communicating the levels of assurance and like what processes were gone through. Now, if you look at sort of NIST standards, for example, you get this, you know, these four levels of assurance. And actually, that is absolutely fine. It's just it's not kind of implemented as a standard yet. There's no mechanism for communicating that information around.
Yeah. And, you know, the last point from me on this is not only does it become expensive and resource draining for the banks in question, it creates a business-centric approach rather than a consumer-centric. So, you know, Joe Smith on the street, who's just trying to open a bank account and get on with his day, is the one that suffers. And they're suffering because there's no consensus and no global or even EU EMEA standards.
So even if we take EU out of the play, you know, when we look in the US, it's well known that, you know, between 20 and 25% of US households are unbanked or underbanked. And primarily that's because of lack of identity. right? But they can't walk into a bank and show a passport or a driver's license. So there needs to be some sort of standards that, because identity is starting to become exclusionary in respect to some of these, or basic access to financial services. But before we go to the break, guys, I do want to get into the COVID impact, if it's possible. Maybe Simon, can you give me a sort of a feel? I know the data is still, you know, coming in on this, but do you expect that fraud has increased during coronavirus as a lack of standards or a lack of digital infrastructure?
Short answer, yes. You know, I think...
Is there any sort of historical precedence for that? What happened during the financial crisis last time in 2008?
Yeah, it's a great point. So in 2007, 2008, when this happened last time, fraud started to surge. As you move into recession, you know, there's a whole host of different reasons, unemployment, desperation, you name it. Fraud thrives like a virus in those environments. We've already seen stats have come out, are continuing to come out, as you say, Brett, about the increased level of fraud now in H1 2020. I believe up to 169%. It's increasing kind of month on month from 2019 into H1 2020. Even the FBI are reporting they're seeing a sharp rise in fraud. In the UK, I believe there was a 33% increase in fraud as well. So undoubtedly, as we continue to move through COVID and into the, you know, sadly unknown but likely recession that goes with it, we are going to continue to see an increased level of fraud just like we have in the last cycle.
Very good. Well, this is a good point to take a break, I think. After the break, guys, we're going to be talking about the future of identity and how that evolves from here. But right now, we need to take a break and have a few quick words from our sponsors. You're listening to Breaking Banks. We'll be right back.
Is your razor in quarantine? I can assure you mine is not. I look in horror at some of these Zoom calls and see Grizzly Adam sitting across from me. In fact, I think a few people have been cheating and started growing their facial hair in advance of the stay-at-home orders. So, what do? I use Harry's. Why? Because razors are very expensive and cheap ones, well, they hurt. And this is where Harry's comes in. They build some of the best blades in the industry, and they've done it by cutting out the middleman, manufacturing their blades in their German blade factory that's been honing precision blades for a century, which means you get an incredibly high quality blade at factory direct prices, just $2 per blade. And the direct is also an important aspect and benefit right now. Those refills can arrive straight at your doorstep on a schedule, with or without a subscription. I love what the company stands for too. Already they were donating 1% of proceeds being put aside for nonprofit organizations devoted to helping provide access to better healthcare for men and veterans. And to help those in need right now, Harry's is donating $1 million worth of shaving supplies to hospitals across the U.S. Listeners of the Breaking Banks show can redeem their Harry's trial set at harrys.com/fintech. You'll get a weighted ergonomic handle for a firm grip, 5-blade razor with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel with alloy to keep your skin hydrated, and when we can actually travel again, a blade cover to keep your razor dry and easy to grab on the go. Go to harrys.com/fintech to start shaving better today.
We're grateful at Breaking Banks to introduce Masterclass as a new sponsor for the show. Masterclass lets you learn from the best with exclusive access to online classes taught by masters of their craft. For example, you can hear from Chris Voss on the art of negotiation, Bobby Brown on makeup and beauty, Neil deGrasse Tyson on scientific thinking and communication. Over 75 different instructors across a ton of categories. There's something for everybody. For me, you guys know I'm a super science tech nerd. And so, of course, what am I going to check out? I'm going to check out astronaut training from Chris Hadfield, his master class on that. How to become an astronaut, how to become, what the astronaut training is like, from leadership skills to survival skills. Phenomenal class and really some incredible insights. So Check it out. I highly recommend you checking out Masterclass. Get unlimited access to every single Masterclass in their library. And as a Breaking Banks listener, we'll give you 15% off the annual all-class pass. Go to masterclass.com/banks. That's masterclass.com/banks for 15% off a range of incredible Masterclasses from masterclass.com. As banks undergo digital transformation and move account onboarding online, a key concern is how to establish trust remotely. Is the person opening an account really who they claim to be? Wide-scale data breaches, spoofing, and deep fakes are just some of the things that make it exceedingly difficult to know for sure. Jumio helps companies automate identity verification using artificial intelligence, biometrics, and certified liveness detection. Jumio solutions are used by leading brands to meet Know Your Customer and anti-money laundering rules, quickly onboard new users, detect and deter fraud, and unlock existing accounts. Learn more at jumio.com. That's J-U-M-I-O.com. Loved by users, loathed by fraudsters. Jumio.com. Hey guys, this is Brett King from Provoke Media and Breaking Banks. Be sure to check out futuristexclusive.com/webinar. That's futuristexclusive.com/webinar, where we're doing an exclusive free live event on the future of business post-COVID-19. Joining me will be Jim Maroos, Dave Birch, Adriana Harris, JP Nichols, Joanne Barefoot, Jason Henricks, and Henry Arslani. And this is a global event free of charge on Wednesday, July 29th, 9 a.m. New York, 3 p.m. London, and 9 p.m. Shanghai. Join us at futuristexclusive.com/webinar.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Hi, my name is Dara Tarkowski. I'm the host of the Tech on Reg podcast at Provoke.fm. Tech on Reg explores all things at the intersection of law, technology, and highly regulated industry. We're talking about fintech and reg tech, cannabis, and sex tech. Join me and thought leaders from around the world to discuss how to pursue responsible innovation.
And now, here's more Breaking Banks.
Hi, welcome back to Breaking Banks. I'm Dave Birch. I'm co-hosting today with my old friend Brett King, and we're talking about digital identity, some big picture stuff, as well as, you know, the instant problems that people are facing in the COVID and post-COVID world. And we're here with Simon Winchester from Jumio and David Tomasson from Metro Bank. And I'd like to sort of get the next part of the discussion going, guys, by asking you to look forward a little bit more. So right now, digital identity basically comes down to the problem of KYC, AML, CTF, PMP, PEP for people trying to set up bank accounts. But as you were saying before the break, there's this whole world of business identities that needs opening up. And then there's kind of where digital identity is going next. And just to sort of get you reflecting on what I mean by that, we haven't really fixed the problem of identity for people. We're nowhere near fixing the problem of identity for businesses. But now we're in an IoT world where we're bringing millions of devices online, where people are talking about embedded financial services and the idea that, you know, your car can pay its road tolls and so on and so forth. And we're also moving into one of Brett's favorite subject areas, which is AI. And again, the conversation to me seems to have been a little restricted in the past because people have broadly been talking about AI as a mechanism for banks to serve their customers, and that's fine. I mean, I like using chatbots as much as the next person do. I couldn't care less if I never spoke to another person again. I'm fine with that sort of thing. But of course, the future is about the customers being bots as well. So we haven't fixed the problem of identity for people. We're nowhere near fixing the problem of identity for businesses. The problem of identity of things is just an absolute nightmare mess at the moment. And we've got the problem of the identity of bots just around the corner. So can I just ask you guys to reflect a little bit, given, you know, you guys have a lot of practical experience on the ground.
Where do we go? Simon, you want to jump in?
Yeah, I'll give it a crack.
You guys must have a position on this, right?
We do. I mean, I think in 10 years' time, it's quite a long view. We'll probably be, identified by our personal pet drones that are following us around at all times and know exactly what we're doing. So that's kind of the 10-year forecast. But I think kind of a little closer to home, we're going to obviously continue to see things becoming increasingly digital. There are a number of EID schemes, government-led schemes. I'm not sure we're going to be owning a physical passport or driver license. And, you know, we're certainly not going to be answering questions like, what's your mother's maiden name and the name of your first pet dog? These things are confined to history.
Thank goodness.
Exactly. Time. I mean, I know Dave has kind of talked passionately about this a little bit in the past. And for me, and I think it's something that you've mentioned, there's a number of different avenues that we can take. And I believe we're going to see an increased focus on consumer ownership of their own digital identity. You know, we've seen legislations like GDPR, et cetera, that have given more power to the people about what can be done with their own identity credentials and who's in control of that. But we're going a step further, and I think we're going to continue to create essentially digital identity wallets. So, you know, rather than sharing your full identity profile when you're onboarding with business A, business B, business C, much like an Apple wallet where you snap and pay, you're snap and share. And that means that you might just, and it will have different flavors. So if you're onboarding for a full bank account and applying for a loan, sure, you'll have to share more data than you would if you're just wanting to prove your age to place a bet or buy alcohol, or just prove that even you have a valid driving license. And it will be the ownership of the consumer of that digital wallet that will control what is shared and with who at what time, so that no longer is it the businesses that control the data, the identity. And so that's part of where I see this going. Being futuristic as well, it's the prominence of biometrics in this process. And that, for me, is going to be the key. You know, we obviously
so they're biometrics absolutely essential for this future, yeah?
Can I just sum this point about wallets, I think, is really important. I mean, I've spoken to you in the past, Brett, and I've sort of said semi-jokingly, oh my God, Apple ID, please come and save us.
Right.
When we were talking about Libra last year, I told you my crackpot theory that Libra was really a wallet play. It really was about identity, not so much the money. And now we've seen, and I think Simon's absolutely right. You know, we need to move towards that kind of model. Just as I have a wallet with, you know, four or five credit cards in it now, I should have a wallet with four or five different identities in that I use securely to access financial services, travel, hobbies, sports, that kind of thing.
So they're on the blockchain, but you have the private key and you decide when you share that.
Whether it's a blockchain or not, let's put that to one side. But I just want to give a little bit of evidence to support Simon's point, which is just last week we saw Apple publishing a couple of patents in the field of digital identity, which patents that were filed at the end of last year but were published on July the 2nd, for precisely this, for precisely and you know, adding identity to the Apple proposition, so that when you go to, you know, you go to a bar, you know, your iPhone will tell them that you're over 21, but, right, but also in the patent filings will tell you where they got that from and what confidence they attached to it and so on. And you know, because banks never got their act together on providing identity as a service, I think just like the way they're relegated to dropping cards into the Apple wallet now, they'll be relegated to dropping identities into the Apple wallet as well.
I was going to suggest something similar on here, because I think my point I was going to make here was the understanding of the consumer, the user in this journey is, I would suggest, now relatively small. And I think the education process that we need to go on to for a customer to take advantage of the rights, for example, under GDPR or whatever, is far too great. I think what will happen is that we'll see, and I'm sure based on where this conversation was going, Dave would agree with me. It's the technology companies, it's the usability and those who own that user experience that will actually drive the agenda around this sort of embracing, if you like, of different levels of digital identity. And I guess almost the, I'm going to use a payments word, the tokenization of what it is that's happening, the abstraction of the user in this sort of space. I cannot see that being a consumer-led journey. What I will see is it's those who own the user experience in this space that will be driving the agenda around digital identity in the future.
Well, that makes sense, because if you think about it, today it's all about gatekeeping. Banks were the gatekeepers for access to banking. Right. And so therefore you had to get your identity confirmed at a bank, right? Or you had to do that identity process at a bank. But now the gatekeepers are the technology layer. You know, you want to shop online, you want to, you know, order your self-driving car and pay for it. You know, you need to have that capability built into a digital wallet, right? Or into that technology ecosystem. So the concept that banks need to collect all of your identity information and that they do it repeatedly through the lifetime of you as a customer, they ask for the same information over and over again, is like crazy. You know, the fact that we haven't addressed that, and the fact that banks don't share that information, you know, broadly. I mean, Dave, you did talk about them requiring a sample of the address usage from potentially a utility company or another bank to verify your identity. But broadly speaking, banks have, I agree with you, Dave, that they've missed this massive opportunity to sort of create a industry identity infrastructure. But we've seen that on, you know, many areas in banking. If it hadn't been for Visa and MasterCard, common payments, you know, electronic payment standards, you know, wouldn't have necessarily just emerged out of the industry either. But
well, I think that's a good point. You know, that's a good talking point actually there, Brett, because I think, you know, one thing you might say is, well, who's going to be the MasterCard of identity, right? Who's going to, now, obviously, well, there's MasterCard for one, and they're spending quite a lot of money on it at the moment. So one candidate for the MasterCard of identity is MasterCard. You know, another candidate might be some other form of bank consortium. You know, you can imagine something being driven out of, you know, other bank consortia, or perhaps steered by some other third parties. But it's entirely possible. And I take David's point completely. You know, the what big tech has got is user experience. They've also got, you know, years of your data, which they're very good at manipulating. But that doesn't mean there isn't the scope for something new in that space. You know, there is always a possibility that, you know, some other consortium will grow up, or something that comes from merchants or brands or media or somewhere, but from a different direction that is more founded on privacy and, you know, looking after individual data. David's absolutely right about the tokenization, because the tokenization of personal data is the key way to avoid sending personal data, which is toxic waste, basically, around the web. And I think I'm rather fond of my new bumper sticker, which is counterintuitive cryptography, because I think, thanks to the miracles of modern cryptography, the kind of things that we can do with cryptographic blinding, zero knowledge proofs, homomorphic encryption, to prove things about the data without actually sending the data around, you know, can deliver some pretty impressive results. But and I don't want to be overly dramatic, but if we don't do something, the banks and whatever, then the alternative is you may well end up with just some giant government ID system, a bit like in India or in China. And those are great and they work very well for their own environments, but I'm not sure they're the cultural fit that we know with our traditions of identity.
Do we just have to get over that? I mean, China, you know, is from an identity perspective and a fraud perspective has just changed. You know, they've turned all those numbers on its head with Alipay and Tencent WeChat Pay. And yeah, while it was originally built by technology companies, it's been co-opted by the government as a centralized identity system. And everyone's freaking out about facial recognition. But the reality is, it works in China, you know, it has reduced fraud. It has increased digital inclusiveness. It's done a number of things. So,
as I say, it's not. I'm not saying it hasn't been very successful in its own cultural context.
But culturally, you think it's a tough fit for Europe and the US.
By the way.
And I would say, Dave, on this, sorry, is I would say I get your model relative to the Chinese model, and let's talk about, you know, the Western side of the world and the economies in Europe and US. When have banks really ever collaborated well without that? I'm going to use the term regulatory stimulus behind it. When has that ever happened? We've not.
They're not incentivized. There's no incentive, you know, like even if you just think about pure capitalism and market dynamics, there's no incentive for them to, cooperate with other banks, collaborate in respect to this, unless it's sort of mandated by standards and the regulator, which is why the US is so far behind on, you know, some of this stuff compared with other jurisdictions like China and India or Kenya, for example, because they choose not to mandate this stuff most of the time. Yeah.
Well, even in its cultural context, it has problems. I sent you a link to that. My current favorite biometric story is the young lady in China who went and had a nose job. And after she had her nose job, she couldn't log into her bank account anymore. or in fact, do anything else. Everything else was done by.
I think there are opportunities.
Perfect. I'm just saying we might want to think about a different kind of infrastructure for our environment.
Yeah, I'm just going to add.
Simon, jump in.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Nordics have done a fair job. Bank ID, you know, the consortium of banks working together to authenticate users to serve clients across the region. Clearly, there's their own interest in mind. And more importantly, in my opinion, again, going back to biometrics, it's always, yes, that's great, but you need that initial onboarding. You need to ensure that that individual is who they claim to be. And even in the Nordics right now, that largely results in someone going to a bank branch or a post office rather than using the technology that we're talking about here. But I think the Nordics have done a good job with great user acceptance rates with Bank ID. In terms of China, I agree, and you know, surveillance, Big Brother, fear of facial recognition. There is always an element of scaremongering. I'll try and be impartial, but for me personally, I think it is the balance between security and surveillance, and there is a fine line. And I think we agree that fraud, and as you said, you know, fraud has reduced significantly based on the introduction of facial recognition. But it's important to remember that take the world that we're living in now, take Metro Bank's use of digital identity verification. It's all opt-in. The consumer is willing and wanting to go through the process to share their facial biometrics, to go through facial recognition because they see the perceived benefits. And actually, they've you know, via Apple ID, et cetera, it's mass adoption and it's part of everyday life now. So it's not a taboo or an unknown. But that opt-in, I think, is incredibly important and different to kind of security to surveillance, which can be manipulated elsewhere.
Are you guys familiar with John Sudworth from BBC? He is a reporter that went to China, hid out in China, and then the Chinese authorities, this was a stunt set up to show how powerful the government surveillance system is. And using CCTV cameras, it just took them 7 minutes to find out where he was, right? now, everyone looks at this and they're starting to freak out. You know, I don't want the government to know where I am. But let's face it, you know, they do. We carry around our smartphones and, all of this tech with us that's just as effective from a surveillance perspective as facial recognition is.
No, you're right, Brett, but that's an argument in favor of having an infrastructure that deals with privacy. I mean, at the moment, we rely essentially on government incompetence as our fundamental privacy protection mechanism. And I'm not sure, I mean, that works in America, it works to some extent in the UK, but it's not a solution. The solution is to have an infrastructure which has privacy built into it, where the parameters of that privacy are set by the society that it's supposed to serve,
right.
not by what technologists can make up. And I think banks have to be part, in fact, not only I think banks have to be part of that, banks should be part of that because, you know, my financial identity my financial passport, if you like, my the thing that gets me into the world of finance, is of critical importance. It's an element, you could argue, of national infrastructure, and it has to work properly, but also it has to work for people, right? So imagine a world like China, except it's run by Facebook instead of, so you've got Mark Zuckerberg rather than the Chinese Communist Party in charge of everything. So imagine somewhere like that, let's call it America, for example, and you need your
Facebook.
Yeah, that's right. You need your Facebook identity, and then one day you wake up and you'll find your Facebook identity doesn't work. You can't log into it. It's been stolen or taken over. Who are you going to call?
Video call.
No, like, at least if I wake up because of my nose job, I can't get into my bank anymore. I can at least go round to Barclays and sort it out. You know, they have ombudsman, they have regulation, they have responsibility, they have customer service, they have, you know,
the plastic surgery review department. Yes. That's like,
they have people.
That's
the point. They have people. Yeah.
But you see what I mean? I think there's the argument isn't just, I think banks should do it because I'm old and conservative and banks have already sunk a ton of money into KYC, which they earn nothing on. There's all these good arguments, but there's a societal argument as well, which is about where should the regulation lie and what the recourse is when things go wrong.
Well, maybe let me put this back to Simon. Simon, you know, as a vendor in this space, as someone working in this space, where do you think regulators and government, you know, could help you guys through this process, through this evolution?
Well, yeah, and I think it's the acting in isolation. So the regulators are acting in isolation from the banks or the vendors and the government. Everyone is doing their own thing, trying to get their own, you know, voice heard. And it goes back to what we were talking about earlier and the lack of consensus. So, I mean, it's blue sky thinking, but to have the ability to take all four of those different aspects, the banks, financial institutions, the regulators, the government, the vendors, come together and try and come to agreement, you know, that is how I, again, it's almost hard to say because it's so blue sky thinking, but, you know, that is how I see a consensus being built. You know, we work very closely with regulators. You know, what comes to mind immediately is in Asia right now. You know, there's a lot of digital banking licenses being released in Hong Kong. Regulators have sought the advice of vendors like Jumio, and we have helped shape those regulations and legislations for the benefit of consumers and obviously businesses in region. But all four aspects of the pie weren't present.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Dave, I am interested in sort of the issue of digital inclusion, right? Or financial inclusion is, you know, in the US, one of the reasons people are excluded from the banking system today is identity, right? So if we digitize identity and people don't have digital technology, if they don't have a smartphone, they don't have a home computer, isn't that going to contribute to further financial exclusion? Just like we talk about the use of cash in the UK at the moment, which you often talk about, you know, are these just further exclusionary measures to put people outside of the banking?
They're exclusionary if you don't have a strategy. I mean, I can't speak for the US, but in the UK, the government doesn't have a strategy, well, full stop, but in particular, it doesn't have a strategy towards cashlessness. And so the idea that you just allow people to drift into a cashless society inevitably causes problems. You end up like in Sweden, where you have people who are marginalized and excluded, and it's not good. We need an actual strategy towards cashlessness. What I would say, however, is I think things have really changed a lot in the last couple of years, Brett, because a couple of years ago, you could have said to me, well, okay, this all sounds great for the 85% of the population that have got smartphones, but what about everybody else? How are you going to bring them in? But now, you know, we've got Siri and Alexa and voice interfaces and biometrics, and, you know, we've even got contactless cards with fingerprints and all this sort of stuff. So now I think we've got like 99% coverage with that. Yeah. And for the 1% who can't use any of those technologies or don't have access, I'm sure we can come up with appropriate, you know, guardianship and relationship-based things. So I think things have improved a lot there. A couple of years ago, there were gaps. I think now the technology is pretty comprehensive.
Yeah, know, I think let's just do one quick sum up of sort of the future, and I'll go around the table and ask all of you guys, in 10 years' time, what is going to be the dominant feature of digital identity or identity in the future world? David, you want to start off? David Thomason?
Yeah, look, I think the biometric stuff will persist and grow in terms of its usage, such that I think we will be working in an environment where people or systems just know who it is that they're engaging with, and I think that will become much more established over the next decade. I wouldn't over-egg it, though. I don't think we're going to have the bot following us or whatever, or the drone following us around and that interacting with us, if I'm honest.
All right, Simon, you'll come back to that.
Yeah, no one's taking me up on my bot idea, so I'm going to set up my own business and go alone, and we'll see. But no, I agree with David. Biometrics is the key here. I do think we'll shift a little bit more into the consumer-owned or managed, may not be outright owned, but certainly managed identity process, with biometrics at the key.
And Mr. Birch?
I think the shift to passive biometrics, I mean, in the right framework, I think the shift to passive biometrics is huge, because we're already...
So you won't have to explicitly sign anything or log in or anything. Yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, when you pick up the phone to call the bank will just know it's you, because the phone knows this is how Dave holds the phone, and this is how he types, and this is the kind of thing he says, and this is where he is. So over that kind of time scale, yes, biometrics, but I'm looking for a revolution around the passive biometrics. They're almost good enough, 99.9% there. Pretty soon they'll be 99.9997, and then we'll go live with them.
Very good. So don't forget to check out Dave Birch's musings on identity and all things a currency Cold War. Dave, how do people follow you on Twitter and find out what you're writing about?
It's at DGWBirch on Twitter or www.dgwbirch.com.
Very good. And David, where can we find out more about Metro Bank?
Obviously, we've got all our information available online. Look for Metro Bank online for the information there. And you can find more about me on LinkedIn. So that's David Thomason at Metro Bank.
Double S. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, very good. We will put a link out to that. And Simon, where can people find out more about Jumio?
Sure, jumio.com. That will take you to the website and everything you need to know about us. And from there, gateway to speaking with me personally, LinkedIn as well, Simon Winchester. That should do it.
What's Jumio's Twitter ID? Do you know?
It's at Jumio.
At Jumio. Yeah, good. All right, well, that's a great show. Thank you all for your participation. It's been a really interesting look into identity. Thank you for listening once again. This has been Breaking Banks. We'll be back with you again next week.
That's it for this week. If you like the show, make sure to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform, or share it with a friend, or share it on social media.
You can listen to all of our more than 300 episodes, plus all of the other shows from Provoke.fm Media, and learn more about being a guest, a partner, or a sponsor, all at Provoke.fm.
We'll see you again next week with more Breaking Banks.